Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The poets have had their way with the question. As earth lies bare to heaven above, wrote Robert Browning, how is it under our control to love or not to love? Well, maybe it's not. Browning seemed to know that. Now science is weighing in. With real chemistry and brain scans, the serotonin and dopamine of love, this hour On Point, the science of love. You can't talk the science of love without a biological anthropologist, and we've got one. Helen Fisher of Rutgers University joins us. She's author of Why We Love, The Nature and Chemistry of Romantic Love. She joins us from New York. Helen Fisher, thanks for being here.
Oh, I'm delighted, Tom.
And with us from San Francisco, Arthur Aaron, social psychologist at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. He's been called a pioneer in the science of love and has looked at love relationships from initial attraction to the rekindling of flames and everything in between. Arthur Aaron, thank you for joining us today.
Hi, Tom.
All right. Helen, without science, what are we missing?
Well, I don't think we're missing anything. I mean, you know, you can know every ingredient in a piece of chocolate cake and still sit down and feel that magic. And in the same way, you don't really need to know a great deal about science in order to love somebody, but to understand what's going on and, in fact, to keep love alive and to realize what's going on in other people's heads, we are really beginning to understand why we suffer so, why we become so addicted, why we can't help ourselves.
Arthur, are we coming to a new depth of understanding scientifically? Has there been some specific substantial progress in recent years because of, I don't know, new technology or understanding of chemistry or you name it? Are we at a new place in our insight?
Oh, I think so. I think we're now in a position where we have a pretty good understanding of who will be attracted to whom, who will develop into a close relationship, what goes on in the brain when that happens, how it develops over time, and why it works better for some than others.
Helen, start to walk us in. You write about the eternal dance. So what do we learn from a chemistry textbook or an MRI scan that we don't know from, you know, just nuzzling and talking?
Right. Well, first of all, I want to say hi to Art. Art and I are doing these brain scanning together, along with Dr. Lucy Brown from Albert Einstein College of Medicine and others. And years ago, I came to think we evolved three distinctly different brain systems for mating and reproduction. One is the sex drive, one is romantic love, and the third is a deep sense of attachment. And Art and I and Lucy began to put people who were madly in love, just fallen in love, into a functional MRI brain scanner. And indeed, we found a lot of things, but among them, we found activity in a tiny little factory really near the base of the brain, in a brain region that apparently makes dopamine, which is a natural stimulant, and sends this stimulant to many brain regions. And it certainly contributes to the focus that you feel, the drive to win this person, the craving for the person, the elation that you feel, the mood swings that you feel. And so that's the first of three experiments that we've done.
So what? You go out and put a butterfly net over somebody who's batting his or her eyes at somebody? I mean, how do you know when
I'm in the full throes
of romantic love?
Well, the first thing that I did is I went through the last 40 years of psychological literature and created a sort of a laundry list of the things that happen when you fall madly in love. And so before we went out and asked people, you know, we would put a sign up saying, have you just fallen madly in love?
If so, come stick your head in our MRI machine.
Yeah, and help science and help people. You know, people are so flexible when they're in love. They're so optimistic. They're so hopeful. And they often want to know what's going on with them. They want to contribute. You can't put somebody in an MRI machine unless they want to go, because you would be measuring fear or anxiety or something else. So, but basically, the most important question I would ask them before putting them in the machine is, what percentage of the day and night do you think about this person? Because it is an obsession. You go to bed thinking about him. You wake up in the morning thinking about her. You know, there's somebody camping in your head. So that was my most important question. The most difficult question for me was to ask them, would you die for him or her? And Tom, a huge percentage of them said yes, as if I'd asked them to pass the ketchup. I mean, you know, this is a powerful, powerful drive that evolved for very important reasons, and it makes you do crazy things.
Arthur, that's the science, the MRI reading of a little bit of the brain when people are in the throes of that kind of obsessive love. But what's been learned about what puts them there in the first place, the scientific path to that excited, exalted, crazy state?
Well, we've learned what leads them there from a couple different kinds of studies. One thing we've done is just collect accounts of falling in love from people who've recently fallen in love and systematically analyze them. And then we've taken those results and done experiments where we manipulate the conditions under which people meet systematically and see who's more and less attracted. Several things matter a lot. Perhaps the single most common scenario for falling in love is meeting someone who is reasonably attractive and appropriate for you, who does something that suggests they like you. Often people will say, at that moment. The other kind of scenario is often where you meet someone under conditions where you're feeling stirred up, physiologically aroused. So you've just been running, or you are scared of something. We did a study once where people met their partners on a scary suspension bridge. And what we found is that when you're physiologically stirred up, and if it's not entirely clear why, you will attribute that to the partner.
I've seen people fall in love in civil wars and kind of revolutions.
Absolutely. Plane crashes and demonstrations and everything that involves being stirred up. Mm-hmm. The falling in love at first meeting is often like that. When falling in love develops, having known the person for a while, it's much more likely to be this scenario of the person being reasonably desirable and appropriate and doing something that suggests they like you. So, for example, one account I recall is a man saying, well, I've known this woman for some time, didn't think much about her. I ran into her at a store, and she smiled at me, and I realized she liked me at that moment. Or another account, a young woman writing, I was talking to my friend about my music instructor, and she said, oh, you know he likes you, don't you? And she said, at that moment, I had this overwhelming feeling of love.
Helen Fisher, are we that easy? That doesn't sound like high science. You smile at the guy, and he falls like a stone. Or in the absence of a plane crash and that kind of excited aura, is it as easy as a smile? Or what about the old, the sort of matchmaking, aunt or who would look at interests and how they fit together?
There's a great deal. I mean, Art is talking about, I think, the work of Theodore Reich, who said love begets love. But there's many more things as well. Match.com came to me years ago and asked me to create a new dating site, and it's now called chemistry.com. And they wanted to know why it is that you fall in love with one person rather than another. So this is actually the topic of my next book. And there's many reasons that you fall for one person. Timing is certainly one. Proximity is certainly one. Magic, mystery is another. That probably drives up dopamine in the brain. But also, we tend to fall in love with people from our same socioeconomic background, same level of intelligence, same general level of good looks, these days same general level of education, and same religious and social values. We also fall in love with somebody who can give us what we need in exchange for giving them what they need. It's called exchange theory. Your childhood plays a role, but we don't really know how. There's a lot of theories on that. And you tend to fall in love with somebody who will give you the lifestyle that you want. But on chemistry.com, I began to think that there's got to be more to it than that. You know, you can walk into a room or into a parking lot or on a suspension bridge and you meet a lot of people in public. And many of them, let's say at a party, are from your background, your same general level of education, your same general level of good looks. There's got to be something more. And so what I did is I devised a questionnaire to see what your biological types is. And what I'm finding is, for example, if you are a person who expresses a lot of dopamine in your genetics or certain activity in the dopamine system, you tend to gravitate to people like yourself.
Why? Because of what characteristics of such a person?
People who express certain activity in the dopamine system, I call them explorers. They tend to be risk-taking, novelty-seeking, curious, creative, irreverent, optimistic, spontaneously generous.
And you want someone who's the same, or does that person end up looking for an anchor who's solid and, you know, keeps the home fires burning?
Tom, that was my hypothesis, and I was wrong. In this particular case, I mean, I've got data on 40,000 people, and mm-hmm. there's going to be outliers, and there's always going to be people who don't fit the pattern. But by and large, that type of I call them the explorer type tends to gravitate to people like themselves. Whereas people who are high on estrogen, I call them the negotiator. These people tend to gravitate to people who complement themselves rather than are similar to themselves. They go for the high testosterone people. And I think that's a very good combination for raising babies because these people are very flexible. They've got a very broad view of life.
So forget the horoscope. We're talking about blood types and hormone levels, dopamine or estrogen.
Yeah, I felt, you know, something like 50% of the variance in your personality does have a biological basis. And we do know, it's called the sweaty T-shirt experiment, we do know that women, you've heard of it. Have you heard of it?
No.
Okay, well, good. But basically, it's been around
for a while.
I may
have unknowingly, exercised it, but I don't know of it. Wait, put your nose in someone's sweaty T-shirt and are you attracted or not?
Yes, you got it. And in fact, what happens is that women are attracted to men who have a different immune system, and they smell it in the sweaty T-shirt.
We'll come back and look at that. Helen Fisher in New York, Art Aaron in San Francisco. Listeners, we're looking at the science of love. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking this hour about the science of love. We're in the love lab on this day before Valentine's. This is your brain on love is the shorthand we've been hearing around here. My guests are Helen Fisher. She's author of the new book, Why We Love, The Nature and Chemistry of Romantic Love. She joins us from New York. She's a biological anthropologist at Rutgers University. Arthur Aaron joins us from San Francisco. He's at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. He, with Helen Fisher, has been doing a lot of research using MRI images to study what the brain looks like when people are in love. Keep the poets in here a little bit. Here's Shelley. Nothing in the world is single. All things by a law divine. In one another's being, mingle. Why not I with thine? What a come on. Paul's calling from Watertown, Massachusetts. Paul, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
You've already touched on my question a little bit, which had to do with smell and what role...
The dirty T-shirt experiment. What do you think?
Right. Well, I was curious whether, you know, how much... the sense of smell and the idea that there are pheromones and that we respond to that plays in the selection of a mate, and also, you know, the whole perfume industry and whether there's anything there.
The artificially enhanced olfactory meeting. Helen Fisher, what about it? I mean, at that level, you know, maybe he or she looks just right for us, but then you smell the T-shirt and it's like, oh my gosh, yes or no. How strong is the sort of intellectual assessment of somebody versus whatever chemical read we get out of the way they smell?
I think they always go together. I don't think you can ever divide those two. And in fact, that's one of the reasons the brain is connected to the body, so that you can have these autonomic responses of either repulsion or attraction, so that you can operate on all levels at the same time. But by the way, when you're really madly in love, parts of the prefrontal cortex begin to shut down a little. So
what does that mean? That I'm more or less attuned to scent, let's say,
or intellectual
assessment.
To intellectual assessment.
But
on to Aunt Paul's question about scent. People differ in their feelings about this. We know that in males' sweat there is, it's a particular pheromone they think called androstenol, which apparently does have some effect on women's feeling sexy. And women tend to have what they call copulins in the genital liquids that apparently drive up testosterone levels in men and
make
them feel more sexy. But, we are largely visual animals, as Art said. You know, we look at the person and we have an immediate response. And it's that visual parts of the brain, I think, that play a larger role. Some others would disagree with me, I think. But mostly we come from the trees, you know, where if you couldn't see, you fell smell out of the trees. And so much of the brain is devoted to the visual responses more than the smell.
Are we going
when,
to...
When people,
yes, all right, please.
When people fall in love, in their accounts, the eyes are often emphasized a great deal. The visual does seem to play a huge role. Physical appearance, especially in falling in love at first meeting, is the only cue you have. But it's not the whole story. People fall in love through different paths. You refer to poets. I mean, mm-hmm. the great story of the Brownings falling in love by correspondence predates the falling in love by email.
No visuals there ultimately, or certainly no smell at that point. But I'm still, with Paul, I'm still stuck on the scent a little bit. Helen, you were saying, you know, that you may have a dopamine match or somebody who's got a high estrogen level may be looking for testosterone. Do we read that in the scent of a potential partner? Or for that matter, you know, the kiss, I mean, the taste is all tied up with scent as well, I guess.
Oh, the kiss is very important. In fact, we have traces of testosterone in the saliva. And also in the saliva, there's indications of what your immune system is like. And so women will respond to, we think that as you kiss somebody, you are doing what we call mate assessment. You're trying to decide whether you like this person. And over 50% of men and women who are attracted to somebody, they report that they don't like him anymore if the kiss is not right. So the kiss is doing all kinds of things. It's telling you a lot about the immune system, something about testosterone levels. Women's scent apparently changes during the course of the menstrual cycle, and men can pick that up. In fact, men like wetter kisses than women do. And it's thought because women have a better sense of taste and smell, and so men need more of these sort of this onslaught of various chemical messages in order to pick up whether they like her or not.
They don't need as much juice to figure it out. Maybe we're going to look more at kisses in a moment. Let me get a call, though, from Peggy in Destin, Florida. Hi, Peggy. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I feel that the falling in love with the pheromones and the brain activity works for about the first year, maybe. And then after that, it's more or less a decision of, you know, whether or not you want to pursue something long-term and whether or not this person, like what Helen was saying earlier, you know, whether they offer the lifestyle that you like, you know. I do think that in some cases you have to be opposite. I've been in a relationship for a year and a half, and we came to a point where it seemed like that rush had gone.
So the raw chemicals only take you so far.
Yeah, and then after that, because my parents have been married for 35 years now, and I think that it really does just come down to a decision, because after a while, things about the person that you don't like do start to surface, and those pheromones don't take care of those things anymore, you know, whereas before it was, oh, you know, but I love him anyway and whatever, and things about the person, like I live with the person that I'm with now, you know, and things about the person start to drive you crazy. And Chris, my significant other, is right. A wreck. He is a mess. He is a doctor who I hear this constantly from people who are married to doctors. He saves everything. He's got his medical, he's 32 years old, and he saves his medical book from, you know, 10 years ago. And
so you got a pack, you know, rat doctor. He's a mess. Yeah. The chemistry's wearing off a little bit. You got decisions to make.
Yeah, and I have obsessive compulsive disorder. I clean constantly. I'm constantly cleaning. And it came to a point where, and not just with that, with other things, it came to a point where we had to decide, is this something we were going to work for, or should we just let it go?
Never mind romantic love. Maybe at that point, you have decisions to make. Peggy, that's a great picture you paint, and we'll look at it. But let me get one more caller voice in on this theme first, if I may. And Peggy, thanks for your call. Linda is calling from Beverly, Massachusetts. Hi, Linda. You're on the air.
Well, I appreciate this show right before Valentine's Day.
Oh, good.
But my contribution is, and I've been married for 48 years.
Good for you.
Certainly not all of them good. And I tease my husband that we've been married 48 years, only three good ones, and we don't even have the same three good ones.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I was going to tell you that the thing, and he was a chemistry major at the time that I married him.
Yeah.
This was in 59 and finishing his master's degree in mathematics, and I was trying to survive freshman chemistry in college, and I thought he was going to help me, but the only chemistry that worked was ours.
Yeah.
But sense of humor was the most significant ingredient, and they have still survived. And there are many times when I have told him, I cannot imagine my life without you in it, but right now I can't imagine my life with you, and I'm going out and do something that I enjoy.
Linda, let me ask you something on behalf of Peggy, who's no doubt listening in Destin, Florida. You made it 48 years in spite of those bumps. Now, do you attribute that to a conscious decision, just a force of will to hang in over that time, or was there something riding underneath, some romantic love, maybe even chemically driven, that helped buoy you along? What do you think?
You have made the significant point. It was a conscious decision that I recognize that marriages evolve from the infatuation period. There's always an ingredient of friendship, and it becomes more mature where you care for each other, and it's not always hearts and flowers. And I know my husband, we joke, he'll get me my box of candy the day after Valentine's when they go on sale.
Linda, you're great.
It is the most significant ingredient, and we always say that the day after Valentine's is the best day of his life. Now, he is also a yard sailor. He brings in so much stuff, and I said it can come in one door, and I make the decision about it going out the other door. But, you know, it's a question of also recognizing that we tolerate the differences,
right,
and also never ever felt from the earliest days that too much togetherness was absolutely a necessary ingredient. I didn't have to pretend that things were always good, and I never did pretend.
Preserve that space
good.
A little bit and find the breadth of mind to deal with the pack rat. Peggy and Destin, it sounds like there's hope right there. And Linda, you are wonderful. But Art Aaron, let me put it to you. What about the issue of short-term, early infatuation versus long-term relationship? Do we call that love as well? I hope so. And what does science tell us here?
Well, for most people, the intensity and the joy and the satisfaction gradually declines year after year. That's the average pattern. And it has to do with the interaction, interdependence. There's problems, conflicts. But that's the average pattern. There are some people who it goes downhill much faster, and there are others, a small percentage, that it stays the same. And indeed, Helen and Lucy and I and Bianca Acevedo and others are doing a study right now where we've identified that small number of people who 10, 20 years later tell us that they are intensely, madly in love. And what we're finding is, and we're only halfway through this study, but it's pretty powerful, is that those individuals, when we interview them, they look like they're in love. When we put them in the brain scanner, they're showing exactly the same VTA activation that Helen was talking about as the newly in love people. So it does seem to be possible. And we've got a pretty good idea of what makes it possible.
Let's hear it.
Well, there's two things. What keeps people together is not the same as what makes them satisfied. What keeps them together is some satisfaction, a lot of investments, you know, children, houses, not having good alternatives. The main reason that abused women stay with their partner is they don't think they've got any alternatives. The alternatives are my husband will kill me or my children will starve. So that keeps them together. And what reduces conflicts is good communication skills, not being too depressed or anxious. But what makes them happy is doing exciting things together, sharing each other's successes, supporting each other when things are down. Those are the things that seem to make for greater satisfaction. What makes people intensely in love who've been together 10 or 20 years, that we're just starting to study.
And is that up to them, or does that get down to chemistry, Helen? You know, something, a kind of a gift of their particular matchup, or is it something deliberate that they create?
I think it's probably both. You got to start out with the right person. Somehow the chemistry has to work, but also, just as Art said, the intellectual goals, the interests, the sense of humor, as Linda said, the similar needs. You know, when Peggy said, "I'm a clean freak," and my boyfriend is a a guy who, you know, a pack rat, it's entirely possible you've gravitated to each other to, you know, because you need one another. So, this is what's so interesting about, you know, Americans love love. They love romantic love. But attachment, that other chemical system, is much more complex. I mean, it's like an oriental rug with a warp and a weft of all kinds of commitment willingness to give and take and memories and things planned together. And it's that's an entire and simply the conviction to get through the bad times in order to move on to the good ones.
So you might have that whether or not your brain lights up the intensity quadrant here,
absolutely.
The 20%. I mean, Linda's saying don't try to hang on to that, you know, nonstop, high, always in each other's arms forever. That's not going to happen. So sort of shift onto a different track and find your satisfactions there, as I read her.
Well, you know what I think what we're going to come to understand as we do this experiment with Art and Lucy and others, that there are more people out there who do feel at least periods of intense romantic love within a long-term relationship, that attachment remains even when you hate the person, the attachment remains, and that you can have spikes of this romantic love when you go on a vacation, as Art says, when you do something novel together, when suddenly the children go off to school, etc. So I think that, as we keep doing these studies, we're going to see that it is possible to sustain romantic love. It doesn't last day in, day out. By the way, it's not supposed to. I think romantic love evolved in order to enable us to focus our mating energy on just one person at a time and start the mating process. But it's probably not designed to be that early, intense stage forever. I mean, how do you get your work done? How do you remember to call your mother?
And, of course, some cultures hold it up more indifferently than others. Let's get another Linda in this conversation from Cape Cod. Cape Cod, Linda, you're on the air.
Hi. Well, this is a fun conversation.
Oh, good.
And I enjoyed Peggy and Linda's input.
Me too.
I always say that the worst time to get married is when you fall in love.
Why?
I agree totally.
Wait a minute. Why?
Because you haven't got your wits about you.
Yeah, but
you
if you did, maybe you wouldn't do it. I mean,
you don't know what you're doing. And a year later, you sort of fall from cloud nine with a big thump, and you realize, gee, do I really want to stay with this person? And if you do that, and you both have to decide this because you're both going to go thump, thump. And that's
hey, the 20% go on giddy forever, we're told.
No,
not 20%.
No. Oh, excuse me, Art, what was it again?
We don't know.
We don't know for sure, but it's more like 5 or 10.
Oh, geez, that's bad odds. Well, Art, what about this observation? Is it better to start a relationship on a super high and hope that that keeps driving you, or is that a sign that you're just going to fall off the cloud?
We thought it would be just what she's saying. But in fact, the evidence is from longitudinal studies over 20, 30 years, people who are more intensely in love when they first meet actually 20 years later are slightly more likely to be happy in their relationship. That's probably mainly due to the other end, though. People who are not very much in love when they first meet in American culture may not do very well over the long run.
You know, I'm not sure.
Most cultures don't see love as such a great thing. Americans are unusual, and love is not the basis for marriage in most cultures, and hasn't been in American culture and for most people until the last 100 years or so.
This kiss, it's criminal.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the science of love. We're in the Love Lab with Helen Fisher, author of Why We Love, biological anthropologist at Rutgers University, and Arthur Aaron is with us. He is with the State University of New York at Stony Brook, out at Stanford this year on sabbatical. Lucky you, Art. They've both done a lot of research on MRI images of people who are stark raving in love. Let's take a call from Berlin in Germany. Wonderful. Kathy, you're on the air.
Hi. I love the conversation that you're having, and I was thinking while I was listening that my marriage for 16 years...
I hope it's a good one. I'm sorry we lost you right there, Kathy, but I've got a note here that tells me, Helen, Arthur, Kathy says she was not in love with her husband when she first got married, and yet they've been happily married for 16 years. What if it's not there at the start, Helen, that kind of rush?
Oh, you can feel a deep attachment to somebody and report that you've... I've met two people in their mid-50s who've never felt the feeling of intense romantic love, and both of them have built very solid, good marriages. They are extremely fond of each other. They have many interests together. They've got children who've made something of themselves. And, you know, these three brain systems, the sex drive, romantic love, and attachment, can visit you in any direction. You can fall madly in love and then feel sexual towards somebody. You can start having sex and then, boom, you fall in love with them. Or you can build a deep attachment that becomes romantic or doesn't. But they all serve the same purpose, which is reproduction, and they do a very good job at that.
We've got another question right down that line, if I may. Sorry, Art, you were saying?
I say the image in some cultures where there are arranged marriages is that you start living together and then fall in love.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I've seen certainly seen that in South Asia and many other cultures. Patricia's calling from Swampscott, Massachusetts. Patricia, you're on the air.
Yes, and this was touched upon briefly in a past discussion as to whether the phrase romantic love was sort of a metaphor, euphemism for the sexual relationship and the quality of sexual life between the partners. And I wanted to explore that a little. I know when I got married, I had a relative say, you know, the most important thing is never go to bed mad. And sometimes a lot of arguments and tension that's built up over the day or week can really disappear when there's that.
Well, Patricia,
really
let me ask you, because I know Helen puts these in different categories, but do you see romantic love as a euphemism for sexual relationships, Patricia?
You know, to me, I think I do, because I think you need more than chocolates and flowers to sort of, you know, maintain a strong relationship over the years, and particularly where you see partners start to drift apart or have affairs, other things that weaken a marriage and ultimately could lead to divorce, you know, I think would be lessened if the couple itself, you know, really had, you know, a good sex life together.
Right. Helen, you've got them in different silos, though they clearly intertwine here. But what define romantic love? What do you even mean by it? Are you just talking sex?
Well, first of all, these two brain systems, no wonder people get them confused because they definitely do interact. Any kind of sexual stimulation drives up dopamine in the brain and can move you closer to the threshold of intense romantic love. And right after orgasm, there's a flood of oxytocin and vasopressin, which are the chemicals now associated with attachment. So that's why I always say casual sex is never casual, because you are likely to trigger brain systems that you didn't expect to get into. Mm-hmm. But anyway, you asked about what the traits of romantic love are as opposed to the sex drive. One thing about a romantic love is it's a sticky substance. If you're in love in the morning, you're in love in the afternoon, you're in love the following morning. With sex, you can have sex and then you're through with that for a little
while. But is it
just
a cultural construct? Or
You know, I have a... the oldest love poems go back 4,000 years, and I think that this brain system for romantic love evolved out of the animal community. All animals feel attraction. I call it courtship attraction for some individuals, and it's now thought that this is not associated with the sex hormones, that this is a different brain system. And so I think we evolved. This is why you can fall in love with somebody at first sight. You know, all kinds of animals in the beginning of the breeding season, they'll avoid a lot of other quarters, and then boom, they'll go and I feel a real attraction for one, and that'll start the
But you're not saying animals have romantic love, are you? Surely.
Yeah, I am. I certainly am. I mean,
they don't write sonnets. They don't. Do they?
No. What you know? What if you were to take a look at two foxes in the beginning of the breeding season, and a male will doggedly follow a female, focus on her entirely, hip hop on his feet as if he's high on dopamine. He's so stimulated. They don't eat. They don't sleep. They give all these affiliative gestures of licking and touching and snuggling and nuzzling. And if you listed those characteristics and said you saw this in the park, and people would assume it was humans, they would think that was romantic love.
We are just animals. Yeah. I want to bring another voice in here, if I may. And I'm sorry, Art, but our time begins to grow short. From Reading, Pennsylvania, Susan Hughes joins us, professor of psychology at Albright College. She has recently conducted a large-scale study on kissing behaviors. It was published in the Journal of Evolutionary Psychology, profiled Monday in the Washington Post, with a headline, "The Differences in Gender Sealed with a Kiss." Susan, thanks a lot for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So you looked at how many kissers, and what did you learn about kissing?
Well, we surveyed over 1,000 college students, and we found very striking sex differences in kissing behaviors and attitudes.
Let's hear them.
We found that females use kissing more as a mate assessment device and were very discriminatory as far as things as the taste and the breath of their kissing partner. And we also found that females use kissing more as a bonding mechanism and to kind of create a pair bond with their partners and maintain this throughout a long-term relationship. And males pretty much use kissing as a means to an end. They use it to seduce their partner and increase the likelihood of having sex, and they'll actually forego kissing altogether if they can get to that end.
You mean they're doing two different things when they kiss? The woman, it's like lip radar. She's trying to figure this guy out, and he's just trying to go for the brass ring?
I think that males will do some sort of assessment so they can assess perhaps the fertility of the female because there's changes in her saliva throughout her menstrual cycle. So there might be some assessment done on the part of males, but I think it's males are more opportunistic maters. And so they're, you know, if the female is willing to have intercourse with the male, they're going to take that opportunity. So males were much more likely to have sex with someone without kissing them first, whereas females were a lot less likely.
But if they've got those different missions when it comes to kissing, does that mean they actually kiss differently? The sort of physical, act of it is different?
Well, I think in terms of certain preferences, there might be some differences there. In our study, a surprising finding was that males preferred a lot more saliva exchange in a kiss, and that they liked this moist exchange, and they wanted more so of open-mouth kisses.
But that's not to figure out the dopamine or serotonin. That's just to, like, get things rolling. As you describe
I would
it.
Think that males, because males have a reduced olfactory and gustatory sense, that maybe they need a little more stimulus to make any kind of assessment. Or I also think that maybe perhaps males just prefer this moist kiss because it's indicative of a female being receptive.
Does that mean females prefer a lighter kiss?
Not necessarily a lighter kiss, but maybe less of a moist kiss.
But don't they, so you say it's an assessment device, but it is as simple as do they have bad breath or not, or do I like the way their teeth feel?
The breath and the taste seem to be the two important things for females, and you know, breath and taste can be indicative of health problems. It also, you're almost putting yourself out there in terms of you're willing to contract an illness from a person by be willing to kiss them. And so you can make certain assessments and possibly pheromonal assessments of your partner when you're in that close of proximity with their mouth.
Helen Fisher, how about it? Do you see, let's say, take it from the woman's side first. Is this mainly an aesthetic assessment, if that's what's going on here? Or is she somehow, are we at some basic biological level doing a chemical readout on the person we're kissing?
I think all of the above. It's a wonderful study by Susan and her colleagues, Gordon Gallup and others, and because we don't really know that much about kissing. But all of the above. I mean, when you think about it, this choice that you will make is one of the most important choices in your life, because if you fall in love with the person and you have babies, you are spreading your DNA on into eternity. So the game of love matters, and kissing is an important part of it, and it's going to do all kinds of things. In fact, in Susan's study, and correct me if I'm wrong, Susan, you found three things. That first of all, it's a mate assessment thing. It can trigger bonding in males, mm-hmm. anyway. Levels of oxytocin go up associated with attachment, and it can also trigger the sex drive. So it's one of those multi-purpose things that gives you an awful lot of information.
But is it really
somebody.
Working for both sexes, Arthur? If the guy's just looking to, you know, score, is the whole panoply really engaged here?
Well, I think the intent of whether your kissing partner is going to be a short-term or long-term partner also makes a difference. So for long-term kissing patterns, we tend to see less of a sex difference. So males and females utilize kissing as a bonding mechanism.
I mean, if they've been kissing for a long time, this is not a first night.
Right, exactly. So as the relationship progresses, you know, how much importance do they place on kissing? And both sexes see it as being an important bonding mechanism. What's interesting is that females actually think the importance of kissing increases as the relationship progresses, or males see the importance of kissing actually decrease as the relationship progresses.
Art Aaron, what do you say for men here, the way they look at this particular expression of romance, affection, drive?
Well,
Well, men can have either a short or a long-term mating strategy in general and with regard to a particular partner. And if they're evaluating whether this is someone they want to raise children with and devote themselves to, then they're going to have one focus for kissing and other courtship behaviors. And if their goal is simply to have sex now, then they're going to focus on something else.
Let's hear from listeners on just this point. Lisa's calling from Belmont, Massachusetts. Hi, Lisa. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Great. What do you know?
Well, I've been married for 25 years, and my husband and I still, we talk about this kissing thing that we really like to kiss, and we really talk about how we like the taste of each other, that I like the way he tastes. He says he likes the way that I taste. I like the smell of him.
Awesome. How many times a day? How many kisses a day or a week or an hour?
We kiss regularly. Not an hour because, you know, we have to work and we have to, you know, raise children and things. But we kiss daily.
How long have you been together?
We dated for a year before we were married.
And together, so that's a total of 26 years.
26 years.
And it sounds like it's still pretty good.
It is. It's great. He's my best friend, and I still, you know, find him attractive. He finds me attractive.
So it's a good chemistry experiment, then. I mean, it's compatible.
I wonder how much of it is chemistry, because I have a really great sense of smell, and his smell to me is very important.
Helen, could it be that Lisa and her husband, you know, are re-upping every time they do this? They're celebrating, but also kind of propelling this relationship chemically.
I think that's a perfect way to think of it. Yes, absolutely. You know, every time you do anything, there's going to be a change in brain chemistry. And, I mean, there's now good data that that you are affecting somebody in all kinds of ways. I mean, with the testosterone, you're stimulating the sex drive. With the oxytocin, you're stimulating attachment. And you're stimulating good jokes and good times together.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Lisa, thanks very much. Let's get a call from Peru, Vermont, and Nancy. Hi, Nancy. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for this wonderful show.
Oh, good.
And happy Valentine's Day.
Same to you.
I would love to ask the researchers whether they've studied the opposite side, those of the brains of those people who suddenly wake up, look at their partner, and say, I suddenly don't love this person anymore. Have they studied, does this represent an infarct to that dopamine camp?
I mean, could some kind of chemical or biological switch have been flipped that sends things south the other way?
Right.
Arthur, what do you say?
We've tried to look at this, but not yet in the scanner. We've looked at people who've been rejected, and we do know that people fall out of love. However, it's actually quite difficult if you want to fall out of love, if you're in love with someone that's not very good for you or is a problem. But it hasn't been done yet.
Helen,
do you know of anything in that line?
I wonder if there's a pattern related to, you know, a stage of life. Is it possible, you know, the guy's testosterone goes down and she stops getting the chemical cue, or vice versa, Helen?
People fall in love at every age. Go ahead, Helen.
No, you go ahead.
You're very compatible. But what do you say, Helen?
It's a wonderful collaboration.
It is. I love what Art just said, that people fall in love at every age. I actually ran into a 2.5-year-old who was madly in love recently. And when one particular little girl would come over to his house, he'd sit right next to her and just stroke her hair.
I remember that. Jody Chalfont, where are you now?
But this is, I think you both raised this very important issue as we're just beginning to look at this. You know, people always felt that love was part of the supernatural. They didn't think that anger was, or depression or anxiety, but they wanted to relegate it to the supernatural. There will always be magic to love, but the more we know about it, the more we can help people understand what's going on.
But does it mean we have less responsibility for kindling or sustaining it? Because, hey, it's all nature. It's all science.
No, never. I mean, you know, you work to keep your friends, you work to stay thin, and you need to work on your relationship. I don't want to say the word work, but as Art says, go out and do novel things together. Novelty drives up dopamine in the brain and can help sustain that system. And as Susan would probably suggest, kiss him. You know, it'll drive up oxytocin and he'll feel attached.
We've got a pretty good idea what makes the difference between satisfying and unsatisfying relationships. There's basically four things. One is that we've well documented from a lot of different research. Number one, learn how to communicate. before marriage, take one of those communication courses. They make a huge difference. If you're already married, take a couples course.
The clock's ticking. Give us 2, 3, 4, Art. What do you say?
Okay, number two, if you're anxious or depressed, get therapy, get medication, or your partner. Number three, as Helen was saying, do novel, challenging. Don't just spend time together. Do different, exciting things. And number four, celebrate your partner's successes.
There you go. The formula. In a nutshell, Arthur Aaron joining us today from San Francisco. Thank you so much for being with us, Art.
My pleasure.
Helen Fisher, author of Why We Love, The Nature and Chemistry of Romantic Love. Helen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
And Susan Hughes at Albright College, big study on kissing. Keep smacking, Susan. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and download the On Point podcast. You'll love it at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.